As I realized that I haven't talked about one of the research topics that I have been spending a significant amount of time on, strong gravitational lensing. So I would like to take this opportunity to tell you about what are these stars that people have been able to detect and study through strong gravitational lensing, and why they are interesting. So since this is I realized that this is the so-called time room, today we will be looking back in time to see what's happening in the young universe. So in order to do that, often mankind's greatest telescopes are not powerful enough. So we have to rely on something that nature provides us for free, which is this gravitational lensing effect. So as you all know, this is one of the most important predictions of Einstein's general relativity. And here I just use a cartoon to very quickly explain why gravitational lensing happens. So you can have any wave source here, be it a light source or a gravitational wave source. If the space-time itself is perfectly flat, then the waves generated from the source will spread out in perfect spheres. But what if there is some mass sitting somewhere which locally curves the warps the space-time, and that causes the wavefront of the wave to behave slightly differently because the local geometry is different from flat space-time. So the net consequence is that the wavefront appears to be distorted, and as it travels more and more, it can even develop some very corrugated shape. And that's when so-called strong gravitational lensing happens, that the amount of light that you see will be very different from without this effect. So here I show a recent JWST image of a typical massive galaxy cluster, just to show you vividly how powerful a gravitational lens is. So galaxy cluster, which is a group of something like hundreds to thousands of galaxies, is the most powerful gravitational lenses in the universe. And in this picture, many of the galaxies, those with the whitish colors, they are member galaxies in the galaxy cluster. But then there are a lot of these background galaxies that, because of gravitational lensing effect, is distorted into typically this arc-like shape. For example, if you look at this part carefully, there are a lot of thin arcs. If this is not impressive enough, when you look at it from the back of the room, then we can zoom into some of the details, and it really shows the power, how gravitational lensing allows us to see distant objects that otherwise we either wouldn't be able to see it at all, or wouldn't be able to really see clearly what is the structure. So for example, here, this galaxy has a lot of star clusters orbiting it. In this case, there's this giant arc, and then there's this very thin arc with beads on it, and you can wonder, what are the aggregation of stars in these beads, and then similarly, these arcs show very impressive structures. So this is why gravitational lensing is a very important phenomenon, because it has a lot of applications in astrophysics and cosmology. So just to name a few, which are like current hot topics in galaxy cluster lensing science. For example, sometimes you're lucky enough that you can detect supernova explosions happening at redshift 1 or even redshift 2, happening in a lensed galaxy with multiple images. In this case, you will be able to capture the same supernova, but at different places, arriving at different times. And the measurement of the time delay allows you to measure the expansion rate of the universe at higher redshift. This is a recent example called the supernova HOPE. The other recent example is, you know, it allows you to really see galaxies. One of the first generation of galaxies at cosmic dawn. This is a JWST picture of a gravitationally lensed galaxy at the redshift 11. It looks nothing like the Milky Way. It's extremely compact. It has two resolved components of size 70 and 20 parsecs, very, very compact. It could be like where the first stars are forming. This such kind of galaxies, if without gravitational lensing effect, it would be impossible to detect. And then another topic I'm actually very excited about with students at Berkeley is to take advantage of this magnification effect and study extreme star formation environment. So for example, in this gravitationally lensed arc, we found very compact so-called superstar clusters. Millions or even tens of millions of stars, they form all together within a very small volume, just a few parsec, and they could evolve into something like the present-day globular clusters. And a kind of science question is enabled by the fact that you can now take a spectrum thanks to magnification. And by analyzing the spectrum, you can understand what happens to the chemical enrichment process in these young systems. Because there has been the puzzle that a lot of the globular cluster stars, they are formed out of materials ejected by other stars that have first formed. So we are seeing a very dramatic process happening that suggests that maybe gas, instead of escaping the system, but actually condense, and maybe is conducive to subsequent star formation. So I'm not going to talk about this in detail today. But if you are curious, I would be very happy to tell you more about it. Today I would like to tell you about so-called extragalactic extremely magnified stars. This is not a telescope picture. This is a theoretical visualization of so-called lensing caustic networks cast by many, many micro lenses in the foreground. These interesting magnified stars detected in lensed galaxies can allow you to first understand the individual massive stars in the young universe. Otherwise, you would not be able to see them individually. And second is, it turns out to be a unique probe of how dark matter is distributed within the lens on very small scales. So this will be the outline of my talk today. First, I will just give you some introduction of gravitational lensing, introduce some key concepts, namely caustic and critical curves, so that we can better understand what I'm going to talk about later. And then I will explain what are really these highly magnified stars seen in galaxy cluster lensing. And I will be talking about several important effects which can be theoretically predicted, and many of them are being observed now. One is microlensing effects of intracluster stars. Here, the intracluster stars are stars in the foreground, and they do something to the appearance of stars in the background. The second thing is in the vanilla dark matter model, we expect that there should be subhalos that are too small to host the galaxies, so they will have some effect. Finally, we might be able to, through these observations, we might be able to detect signatures of very tiny structures in the dark matter, which is not predicted in the vanilla cold dark matter scenario, but it could be there in some of the other dark matter scenarios because of physical processes happening in the early universe. So what is geometrical lensing? It's easy to explain using this cartoon that you have source located on the source plane, and then you have a lens represented by this fuzzy ball located on the lens plane, and then this is the location of the observer. So the key thing is you wanna ask, how does the light ray go from here to some point on the lens plane, and then it gets deflected, it's bent because of gravity, and then eventually reaches the observer. So this is described by the ray equation that says if you measure everything in angles, then the angular position of the source is equal to angular position of the ray on the lens plane minus a deflection angle. This deflection angle is determined by the mass distribution of the lens. So basically, for almost all applications, you can compress the lens into a two-dimensional sheet.
Why is the lens a single plane?
That's a good question, because the physical size of the lens, the 3D size, is usually much smaller than this longitudinal distance. So it turns out that it's a good approximation to simply compress all the mass into two-dimensional sheet. Only the surface density matters. Okay.
Can I ask you another question? So what determines whether or not you're in the geometric optics limit?
Basically you want to compare the wavelength with the some gravitational length scale, something like gm over c square of the lens.
So that's the Schwarzschild radius of the object.
It's not. It's typically much, much smaller than the radius of the object. It's the Schwarzschild. The Schwarzschild. Yes.
The
yeah.
Schwarzschild.
Yes. Yeah.
So if I see. Okay.
Yeah. So for most astrophysical lensing of light, of optical light, geometrical optics is good.
If you have an extended distribution, well, I guess for our purposes, they are point sources. But if it's an extended distribution?
Yes, so if the source is extended, then you...
The lens.
The lens.
Yeah, if it's an extended mass distribution, what determines compared to the impact parameter?
So when it's extended, basically, I think the connection... So one way to think about the connection between wave optics and the geometrical optics is you think about the Fermat principle, that you have this travel time, you have this travel time as a function of x, and that function can be visualized as some height, kind of height. So then basically, in the short wavelength limit, only the stationary points of that function, namely either at the top or at the bottom or at the saddle points, those give you individual geometrical images. But you can then quantify around each image, how big is the coherent zone of the phase of the wave. So if you find out that that coherent zone is big enough that they are joined together, then that means you probably the geometrical optics approximation will be very bad.
Thank you.
Yeah. So here it's very simple. It's just a ray equation. And one important concept is if you consider locally a bundle of rays, How does the cross section of the bundle here compare to the cross section of the bundle here, as illustrated in this way? Then that is basically the Jacobian matrix, which is encoded by two quantities. One is called convergence, the other is called shear, two components of the shear. So loosely speaking, the convergence is a measure of the surface mass density of the lens, relative to something called the critical surface density. This critical surface density only depends on distances and fundamental constants. The shear is they are usually quantities of similar order, but they describe anisotropic deformation of the bundle. So then one important quantity is if you compare the area of the two cross sections, that gives you the magnification factor for the flux, which is basically 1/1 the determinant of this Jacobian.
How do we know that the bundle is not rotated as well?
That's a good question. So it turns out that if you only have a single lens and if the deflection is generated by Newtonian gravity, you can show that there's no rotation in the bundle. So it's a kind of special case. But for example, if you have two lens planes, you can still define a overall Jacobian matrix, and that matrix, you can have another free number here. Okay, so here I just use some visualization to explain the idea. This is the source plane. I put a circular source here. This is a lens plane. And then I can use the ray equation to map from here to here. So you can see that as this source moves around, I can have different shapes and positions of the images. And so one thing is that lensing conserves surface brightness. When you see a source that is magnified, the reason is because it looks bigger in angular units. The second thing, so basically magnification means bigger sources on the sky, and the demagnification means smaller sources. The other thing is multiple images can form. The mapping from the lens plane to the source plane is unique. But however, given a source position, you could have multiple mappings. So that's why here you can see that sometimes multiple solutions can appear.
Sorry, what is your lens here?
What
is your lens?
Here this lens is just something called an ellipsoidal singular isothermal ellipsoid. It's some toy lens. Just
1/r², but
yeah, but with a shear, because I want to create this thing which I will explain later.
You just said you would explain them.
Okay. Yeah. So now here's the important concept called the lensing caustics. Imagine you have a swimming pool, and sunlight will incident on the surface, and get refracted, and then eventually reach to the bottom of the pool. Now, because the surface is wavy, so that the sunlight is deflected by different amounts at different places. So, if the sun rays are incident uniformly onto the surface, by the time they reach the bottom, they don't land uniformly. And some places there are more rays, and it appears brighter. So then these places are basically the caustics. They are some places that the rays happen to all land there. Here I just use a simple visualization. So you have a source here. You have an observer here. You backtrack the rays. You shoot rays uniformly onto the image plane, which is the blue thing. And then on the image plane, there's a lens there that deflects each ray. So then, because this deflection is non-uniform, by the time the rays reach the source plane, which is the red thing, you can see that they don't land uniformly. And interestingly, there are some places that the rays are infinitely concentrated. So these would correspond to places with infinitely large magnification, and they are called caustics. So you can see these caustics here. So this is what I'm color coding in here. The green color corresponds to the total magnification factor as a function of position. It shows these discrete places bounding a curved diamond shape. And then this is the caustic. And this caustic, following the ray equation, maps to the critical curve, which is this ellipse here. So you can see that the caustic is where if the source passes it, there is some abrupt change of the number of images. So for example, when it passes its caustic here, you have images either emerging, you start with zero and you get two, or two images annihilate with each other. So this mathematics is called a catastrophe theory. So it deals with the discontinuous transitions between the system given a smooth variation of the underlying parameters. So what is interesting about this catastrophe theory is that it says close to where this discrete change happens, the behavior is universal. It can be classified into different types. So for example, here I use this to visualize. If you have imagine you have a curved surface and then you see it in projection, then you can see that if you view from some angle, you might have a abrupt change of number of projections, right? And that location is called the caustic. So then this is something called a fold. This is something called a cusp, because you see this very pointy thing. This is called a cusp. There are actually infinitely many more complicated types of caustics, something called a swallowtail, butterfly, increasingly fine-tuned types of caustics.
And so you said that this, the features are universal. This is true in all dimensions, or do we know that's true in all dimensions? Or only in two dimensions?
So for example, fold and cusp correspond to two dimensions. These higher order catastrophes, they live in higher dimensions. This higher dimension is not spatial dimension, it's a dimension of parameters. I think so. I think like they're like universal.
When the caustics corresponds to like imply infinitely magnified.
Right. Because it is basically a special situation that this element becomes infinitely small. So all the rays, they get focused on one point. So then this ratio is infinite. Okay, so, but I should just say that for application, I would just be talking about fold, because all the other ones requires fine tuning. It's very rare.
Harry, when you were saying dimensions based on the parameters, which parameters are you talking about?
For example, for fold and cusp, it is basically where you are on the source plane, so two parameters. But for these, for example, in order to get it, you not only have to tune the source position, you have to tune some other parameters, such as distance, or you change your lens in a continuous way. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I will be focused on the fold, the caustic, which is the most relevant thing. So the universal, here's the universal thing when you have a source very close to a fold caustic. In this case, you have the caustic is almost like a straight line locally, and that maps to a straight line locally for the critical curve. And then the source is lensed into two images. They are located symmetrically about the midpoint, equally magnified, equally sheared. And there will be three parameters describe this simple fold. One is the local convergence value, which is assumed to be almost a constant in the locally. And then there's an angle, this alpha, and then there's this so-called second derivative of the deflection, a parameter d. It has the dimension 1 over angle. So basically, when you have such a situation, the source is magnified very mildly in the perpendicular direction, but can be magnified very dramatically in this direction. And the magnification in that direction is inversely proportional to the separation, to the critical curve. So what is interesting, therefore, is that you can ask, what is the area on the source plane such that I can achieve a magnification factor above some number? and that is inversely proportional to D. So then you can say D is quantifying the strength of the caustic. If D is small, then you have more area to achieve high magnification. If D is large, you have less area. And D actually, for big lenses, D is small. For small lenses, D is big. And because everything in the universe is moving, so you can imagine that now if you measure flux as a function of time, you get a light curve. And this light curve, when the source is far away from the caustic, has this universal behavior, increase as 1/t square root. But then at some point, the magnification will saturate because the source starts to graze. If you have a finite size source, it starts to graze the caustic. And then once the source going past that, all images disappear and flux drops to zero. Of course, this situation can happen in the reversed fashion, can go this way. Okay, so now this kind of caustic situation is commonly found in the universe. We are particularly interested in the so-called cluster lensing field. I have this giant galaxy cluster halo hosting many galaxies. To zeroth order, I can ignore these galaxies. Just think about this smooth dark matter halo, which is sufficient to generate its own caustic. And this kind of situation, let me just use one real picture. So you have a lensed galaxy that looks like this. And I can immediately tell that it is actually two lensed images joined together along a critical curve. Because when you look at the details, you see the mirror symmetry of the features. It's mirror symmetric. Okay. So Jordi Miralda first proposed that if you have a source, let's say a star living inside that galaxy that happens to be very close to the caustic, then the magnification achieved is basically inversely proportional to D and inversely proportional to the separation to the critical curve. And even for something very small, that the telescope can resolve, something order 0.1 arcsecond, you can estimate that the magnification factor can reach hundreds to thousands fold. And this makes the star detectable even at cosmological distances, provided that the star is not something like our sun, but some extreme stars. So if you classify all the stars on this famous HI diagram, temperature dropping along this axis and luminosity increasing along this axis, then there are three types of stars that are promising. One is the most massive Mayer sequence stars. They are very hot, so their total luminosity can reach something like a million times of the sun. But currently, the hot Mayer sequence stars, they are not the most promising target because most of the energy goes out in ultraviolet, which we cannot see. The more promising types are, one is called a blue supergiant, stars that have exhausted the hydrogen in the core, and it is doing some shell hydrogen burning. And it has bloated to something like 100 solar radii and appears extremely bright in optical because it has the right temperature. Another type of beast is called a red supergiant. Only some very special evolutionary stage for massive stars. And they can blow up to something like 1,000 solar radii, but they are very cool. The surface temperature is very low, so they appear the brightest in the infrared. So it's interesting that it seems that recently the JWST data has uncovered a lot of lensed red supergiants. So I'm going to show you some observation. This is the first detection, serendipitous detection. People were monitoring some lensed supernova, so took many pictures. And then there's this lensed galaxy with a spiral arm that crosses the caustic. So you can see this faint structure. And a source appeared very close to the predicted location of the critical curve. And you can't really see it in this figure. So this is the zoom up view. You actually see two sources, which may be the image pairs. And the evidence that it's a supergiant star is the SED shows this Barmore break, which is very consistent with a blue supergiant of something like 10 to 15,000 Kelvin and 100 solar radii, magnified by several hundred times. There are more detections in other examples over the years. Here, there's some detection coming out of some star-forming region of this kind of cosmic crossing galaxy. This is called a Christmas tree because every time you take a picture of it, something shows up, but it pops up at a different place. So it's like the Christmas light. This is a recent example where there's a red source in JWST image, and it's potentially the first detected red supergiant. And this is a so-called Arendelle star was all over the news earlier because it's in a redshift 6 galaxy. It's very puzzling because it's a lone source, only one image without counter images, sitting almost exactly on the predicted location of the critical curve. So some people theorize that it could be something like a low metallicity 100 solar mass star magnified by some extremely dramatic magnification, something like 8,000. The exact nature, in my view, of this object is still uncertain. So most recently, people figure out that a very
How do we know it's a single star?
Oh yeah, so this is because a size constraint. Because you near the caustic, you expect to see two images, but there's only one. So then people say this must be because either it's exactly on the caustic or the two images are too close to each other. If you know the D parameter of the caustic, which people predict from the lens model, then you can constrain the size. If the size is too big, then you are supposed to see a resolved source. So from that, people put a bound saying this source is less than something like 0.1 to 0.3 parsec. And therefore, they suggest it's a single star, or at least dominated by a single star. But the caveat is that the D parameter can be affected by substructures. So this is some ongoing investigation that I'm working on. Another interesting advancement is this flashlight program. So Patrick Kelly, who found the first star, suggested a method that you can take pictures of the same field of view in identical conditions but separated over 1 year, and then take a difference of the image. And in that way, you can detect any variable source popping out on the lens of the galaxy. So they find that whenever they target a caustic crossing galaxy at redshift 1.7 to 1.5-ish, they always detect transients in just two images taken at random times. So this is indicative of the high abundance, high occurrence of such phenomena. Although I need to explain why the source is varying. So let me explain later. Right, so perhaps the surprising aspect of such a detection is that the two images, they are not equally bright and they are flickering independently. You can measure the light curve. They're actually doing some random thing, okay? So this means that there's something missing in our theoretical picture, which is the next thing I'm going to talk about. So it turns out that you have to account for the granular things inside the lens. And the first population of such things is called intracluster stars. So you typically see this diffuse light filling the entire field of view. This is not an image artifact. This is real. It is a halo of randomly floating stars. And it turns out that these stars will act as microlenses and give variability to the highly magnified stars. So basically, if you consider each single each single micro lens modeled as a point mass, it can cast its own caustic, but a very small, smaller than your telescope can resolve. The typical size of this diamond-shaped caustic is characterized by the Einstein radius, which typically is something like a 1 microarcsecond, very, very small. So you can quantify how many stars, how many such micro lenses are there by this so-called coarse-grained convergence parameter, which is basically the mean surface density, the local mean surface density of these discrete objects divided by the critical density. Then the value of this kappa basically is a measure of the area covering factor when you add up all of these diamonds. So for example, here kappa is 3%. So that means there's a lot of area that is outside the diamond. You shouldn't be affected by microlensing. You need to be pretty lucky to fall somewhere here. Okay, so.
So if these are point masses, why are they not symmetric? Why are they diamonds and not squares?
That's a good question. Because there's the shear coming from the background lens. So here I'm showing a very local patch of the whole lens. And the large scale mass distribution has a shear that breaks the isotropy. And also, isotropy can actually be broken by neighboring point masses too. You can increase this number density. This is 30%. Now you start to fill up the area, which I then call optically marginal. You further increase. You have so many caustics that they are overlapping with each other in a crazy way, so that you get this rather like Gaussian random thing. This I would call it optically thick. So if you actually do a calculation of how many micro lenses are there, you can measure from the intracluster light. You typically find that only 1% or less is mass is in the form of stars. The rest, 99%, is in the form of dark matter. So then it's very strange that why it should be deeply in the optically thin regime, why we have this phenomenon happening all the time. It turns out that when you embed these micro lenses in a region where the macro magnification is very large, the correct criterion to judge is optically thin or marginal or thick is not one, not comparing kappa star to one, but comparing kappa star to one divided by the magnification factor. So in this case, even though I just have 1% of the mass in discrete objects, but because my magnification factor is 200, you can actually see that the caustics, they are overlapping with each other because they are greatly compressed on the source plane. It's actually in the optically thick region. So this means that if I'm sufficiently close to the macro caustic, my background magnification is high enough, then even a tiny amount of surface mass in stars can make you in the optically thick region. I'm going to skip this slide, but talk about this. So then it has important consequence. If you have a star moving across this caustic network, then the magnification factor will vary. And every time it crosses a microcaustic, it temporarily peaks. Okay. So then the typical light curve has this kind of very non-Gaussian behavior. These peaks are due to microcaustic crossing. And you can estimate that depending on the radius of the star, the peak magnification is something like 10,000 fold. If someone tells you, I have a star magnified by 1,000,000 times, that's physically not possible. And this network can be so big that the star will transit the network for a long, long time. So it will repeatedly have these kind of peaks. And this is very important for observation. So here, let me just show you a animation. What I'm going to show you is, so this is on the image plane, and these gray lines are critical curves. There are many micro lenses, so there's a complicated network of critical curves, and the image will be indicated in red. For this panel, it's very small, so you may need to see carefully. So what I'm going to show is, as the source moves across this network, how do the images form and how do they behave? So I'm going to play both cases. This is a smaller disk, a smaller star case. So the images look small. This is a bigger star case. They look big. So you see that you form many images in the optically thick case. They form a train, and the train overall is moving this way. But each image, if you watch carefully, can move in the opposite way, and they are constantly merging, merging on the critical curve, re-emerging on the critical curve, doing this kind of behavior. Now, this kind of behavior is on extremely small angular scales. No telescope can resolve it. But what you can observe is the time variability of the total flux. So that explains the microlensing behavior.
I think I missed when you said, when you say smaller stellar disk, are you talking about a single star and it's just a smaller star, and larger it's a single star but a larger star? Or is it?
Yes, so smaller, this means a small star.
Okay.
This means a larger star. But actually, because I want to make you see the images, so both stars are unphysically large.
Okay.
The actual stellar size would correspond to images so small that you cannot actually, it's difficult for me to visualize it here.
Sorry, you said no telescope can resolve this, but we can resolve this microarcsecond.
Not in optical.
So what is the resolution for Gaia? Astrometry for Gaia.
Oh, Gaia is looking at incredibly bright stars and doing.
This
is very faint, so yes. You can't do this square, one over SNR thing.
Okay.
Is the number of these micro images the order of the optical depth? Is that how I should think about it?
It certainly depends on optical depth, but I don't remember, is it linearly proportional or, but you're right that if it's in a very optically thick regime, you have many, many images.
Physically, what is the object that's causing, that's making this lens?
Oh, it's the stars inside the lens. So the lens is big, but there are many, many small stars.
So these stars also have been intrinsic by this loop and also associated with
them. Good question. So these are always dwarf stars, like subsolar mass. They're extremely faint. So we only see the collective light. We can't see them individually.
We can subtract the collective light from the image that's...
We don't have to, actually. The dwarf stars are so faint that we can simply ignore them. Okay, so here is just some interesting application that is led by an undergrad student at Berkeley. So basically, whenever you cross the microcaustic, temporarily the star is so bright that you can do some careful, in principle, you can do some good light curve measurement. So then it turns out that if you measure the shape of the light curve near the peak carefully in multiple different bands, you can measure the properties of this massive star. So for example, you can measure the dimensionless stellar rotation, because if the star is faster rotating, it actually becomes flattened and has a non-uniform surface temperature. You can infer these stellar parameters, which is, if we can capture the brightest moment, you should be able to do it with Hubble or JWST. Okay, so now so much for the microlensing effect. There could be a different layer of substructure. So the microlenses are on very small scales, but if you believe lambda CDM theory, there should be a lot of these subgalactic dark matter halos of millions to billions of solar masses. These halos, they are too small to host galaxy formation, so they should be invisible. You can only detect them through gravity. So of course we have learned a lot through cosmology studies what should be the prediction for these things. Basically about 10%, up to 10% of the mass locked up in the big halo can be in these subhalos of different masses. There's a power law mass fraction function according to numerical simulations, and the power law is such that every time you decrease the mass by a factor of 10, you roughly increase the number by a factor of 10. And of course, people are interested in knowing if these things exist or not, because depending on whether you have cold dark matter or warm dark matter, you may or may not have these small halos. So in fact, some of the relatively large halos, billion solar mass, invisible halos have been detected in some strong lensing application. This is a Einstein ring seen submillimeter. So this is not a real picture, but the people through reconstruction, people think that there is some substructure here. Okay, but in general, these substructures are very difficult to detect gravitationally because their surface mass density is too low compared to the critical density. So here I just draw a diagram increasing halo mass and putting them increasingly this far away. You can see that in almost all cases, the convergence parameter is still much smaller than one. Only if you approach the largest halos, those host the galaxies or clusters, and put them like at a cosmological distances, they may reach order unity. So this makes it very difficult to detect these subhalos individually, especially if you want to go to like million solar masses. However, I can argue that if you look near the macrocaustic, then it becomes more hopeful. This is the reason. So it is true that convergence and shear has some large contribution from the big lens and has some small contribution locally from some substructure. And these numbers are very small, much smaller than one. However, if you are near the caustic, your Jacobian matrix is very close to being degenerate. So even a small perturbation can make huge change in magnification factor. So that's the trick. For example, you can focus on some local region of the caustic. This is this is showing, let's say you look at a caustic crossing galaxy locally around the caustic and this is the image plane. So this is the critical curve. With just the smooth lens, you would expect a very symmetric, almost a perfectly symmetric distribution of the magnification factor around it. But once you start to put in the expected cold dark matter subhalos, when the subhalos are very far away, they only make very small perturbation, insignificant. But very the closer you get to the critical curve, the more significant the effect is. So you can be so significant that the main critical curve is actually disrupted. And the consequence is that now, if you look at two images of some source on either side of the critical curve, they may become significantly unequal in flux. So this is we think this is happening in some example, this caustic crossing arc. You can see in Hubble images these compact clumps, the most likely collection of young stars, but they are not equal. You can identify some pairs, but they are significantly unequal in flux. So we think that this is very difficult to explain using microlensing, but can be perfectly explained if you have this expected population of cold dark matter subhalos, million to 100 million solar masses. Another effect is astrometry. You not only ask.
Have people done analysis to see whether or not that matches CDM predictions?
So here, these simulations we are using. So we are basically taking models calibrated to, let's say, cluster scale n-body simulation that gives you a mass function of subhalos. But you don't, so in simulations, because of limited number of masses, you cannot really go to million solar masses. You go to something like 10 to the 9 solar masses. And then you do some extrapolation because you see a very good power law. So there's no reason to think that suddenly the power law changes. And then you extrapolate that there, and then you also populate these halos based on the expected concentration parameters, assuming some NFW halo. So yeah, so these calculations, these simulations are based on that kind of model. So at least for that calculation, and if you vary the number by a factor of few, you typically find that you are in this kind of situation. Not that there are no effects or there are like too much effects. Yeah. So far, I would say it seems that the observation, there's no evidence that the reality is very, very different from cold dark matter expectation.
I think Ashita Neil did this 20 years ago, but.
Yeah, so that's right. And but here I want to argue that you can go down to like a million solar masses because far away from the critical curve, it's really difficult to see their effects.
Yeah, I can get much closer then.
Yeah, yeah. Another effect is the astrometric effect.
Sorry, I had another question. Can you go to the previous slide? The one after.
Oh, this one.
Yeah. Oh yeah. How do we know? I mean, is that not like a star clusters instead of dark matter subhalos? Because
you mean
what you need is just clumps of mass, right?
These we think are like clumps of young stars. Some, you know,
right.
Could it be star cluster? Could be some.
About you know the lensing substructure.
Oh, the lensing. Or why they are not star clusters?
Yeah.
In general, you find that the star clusters, their abundance is very low. So there could be globular clusters in the inside the galaxy cluster, but because the globular cluster it will contribute to light. So we know that typically only up at most like a few percent of the mass is in stars, the rest is in dark matter. So when you then populate these halos, you find that the number of these halos are way more than like clusters.
Yes, the numbers are, of course, there's much more mass in them, but the global clusters are much more concentrated. So
that's a good question. So it turns out that on these scales, if you talk about like a million solar mass, 10 million solar mass, they behave not very differently from point mass. But of course, globular cluster would be perfect point masses on these scales. The other effect is astrometric effect. You can ask, will the substructure change the location of the image? And again, you naively would say that the deflection angle predicted by gravity is very small. It's below the resolution of your image. But when you are getting close to the critical curve, again, this background large magnification helps you. You can show that the actual change in the image position is amplified by basically the magnification factor relative to the actual deflection from the little structure. So this is shown here. If you are close to the critical curve, the shift is bigger than if you are further away. So then this means that I can try to see some astrometric effect. I can focus on some local region where the caustic, where the critical curve passes this arc. And then if I can detect the compact sources, many of them, if the local mass distribution is smooth, I should expect to see these symmetric pairs. Each pair can have different separation, but their midpoint will basically trace this very smooth through smooth critical curve, almost like a straight line. But this is what you can get when you have these subhalos. So the critical curve goes around like a snake.
So here are you assuming that these background sources are all the same redshift?
In the same galaxy. So I basically say, let's just focus on this galaxy if I could detect some sources. Yeah. So we could do some simulation by injecting expected CDM subhalos. So here I inject down to 10 to the 8, here down to 10 to the 6, here down to 10 to the 4. So basically you find that below 10 to the 6, the effects become very subtle, that it's probably not easy to see it. So it's, again, sensitive to something like down to 10 to the 6 solar masses. But you can't really see this critical curve shape, so you have to rely on astrometrically locate the image pairs. And then one way might be you detect these highly magnified stars. You detect, let's say, a dozen such stars. So this is done some a while ago, but recently a lot of stars have been detected in the latest JWST images. I wish I could show you one image because it really looks very impressive. But at this time, I am not allowed to show it. But I should just say that many stars are detected, but this application is not straightforward. The reason is we are helped greatly by microlensing. So we don't actually see that this pair. We see one of them popping up at a single time. But the number is somewhat surprisingly high. So I would say that this application, we have to think about it more carefully. But at least the good news is there are many stars. OK, finally, I'm going to talk about a more, you know, if nature is kind, maybe there's even finer structure that we can look for. Let's say that, you know, one scenario is that if dark matter is made of axion with the right mass, and the axion may form out of the Petri-Quine symmetry breaking after inflation, and then you would form this network of topological defects in the early universe. And then these topological defects will evolve dynamically as the universe expands and eventually dissipate. So this is some a numerical simulation of this axion string network evolution from like formation to some scaling evolution, and then eventually it dissipates. But then the consequence of that is you end up with some distribution of axions that eventually become non-relativistic, that is spatially non-uniform. And that leads to some small-scale power in the initial condition of the universe. So here I show the typical variance of the density as a function of scale, of the density contrast as a function of scale. And then you can, so this line is what you get from inflation that is growing toward small scales, but then kind of flattens out. The effect of this axion network decay can give you an additional contribution that cuts off on like this the scale that I show in the previous slide. But then on larger scales, it's a white noise power. So then following some simple analytic structure formation theory, you can predict that there should be some unusually dense and compact gravitationally bound halos forming. And people did some simulation here to show how well the analytic theory agrees with reality. So if the axion is something that is supposed to explain the QCD strong, the strong CP problem, then these mini halos may have solar system sizes and may weigh something like asteroid to planet masses. So they could be flying all over the galactic halo, have very low volume filling factor, but it's very difficult to detect them individually. So then here, if such things exist, then you have a fourth layer of substructures of these mini halos. But here the cartoon may not be super super realistic, because in fact these mini halos, there are so many of them that when you see in projection, they are overlapping with each other. So they behave like some kind of Gaussian random fluctuations in the surface density. So then some time ago, I suggested with Jordi Miralda that if you watch carefully when the star crosses one of the microcaustic, temporarily this magnification factor can be something like 10,000, very high. And then even some tiny level of fluctuation in the surface density can do something to the light curve. So here I just show you some visualization that imagine you have a super powerful telescope that can really resolve these two micro images. They are kind of merging together onto the critical curve. If you have these additional fluctuations, then the light curve will not behave smoothly. So the suggestion is that we should try to capture some we should try to capture some wonderful moment like that, and then measure the light curve. Basically, something you would need to do, as in this previous example that I said, you can measure the properties of the stars if you assume these axiom mini halos don't exist.
But in reality, you have a stars here as well. So you have. You don't have a smooth update. You have the stars with all the structure you show.
So this scale is like super, super small. So this is like maybe.
This is a smaller than.
So it's like I have many caustics cast by the stars, and then I'm focusing on like what happens in the very vicinity of one of them.
So would the planets around those stars then make similar effects, or?
People ask this question. So I think we are good because if the planet is bound to the star, it's actually so close to the star that it won't affect this. Only free floating planets can do something like this. But free floating planets, I think the abundance, according to Milky Way observation, is very low in terms of mass density, kappa. Yeah. So I think, yeah, I would be surprised that there are a lot of planets doing this. Okay, so I don't want to talk about some more technical aspect, but just say a few words. I think in light of a lot of data, so the impressive thing about the JWST data is that people took two random images, and they are not even from a program designed for science like this, and it's not scheduled for special times. You take the difference and you see many, many stars. So that means there will be a lot of data in the future. So then we have to develop some statistical tools to interpret the data. So basically, can we quantify the light curve statistics, like what's the magnification variance? What is the two-point correlation function in time? What is the PDF distribution of the magnification for single stars? These quantities, not all of them can be analytically calculated, but at least can be simulated from first principle. So there are some work toward that direction. The second thing is, and you can not only use individual very significant stars, but a lot of the other information might come from either a collection of blended stars or maybe just some pixels on the arc. Each pixel will contain a population of stars. You can't separate them. So then you can also develop a theory to describe the variability of the collective light. For example, here, individual star will behave in this extremely non-Gaussian way. But when you put them together, you find that independent of the stellar luminosity function, the collective light behaves like a scale invariant process in time. So you can predict the power spectrum. So you behave like this. On small scales, it still behaves non-Gaussian, but on long time scales, it becomes very Gaussian. Yeah, so the hope is that if we can get these predictions accurate, then we can judge if the observation is consistent with known physics or there has to be something new.
What is the x-axis here?
X-axis is time, and the y-axis is like flux. Finally, so I mentioned this axiom mini halo, but it turns out that many other early universe scenarios, they can produce structures on very small scales. So for example, axion large misalignment, some vector boson produced during inflation and behaving as dark matter later, early matter domination in the past, maybe before radiation epoch, and then some primordial kination era. So the details differ in different models, but in many cases, you produce these very dense things that you can't really probe using other ways, but you can probe if you can watch this highly magnified star carefully. Okay, so I would like to just end with this summary slide. So the individual massive stars can be detected from cosmological distances thanks to this extreme magnification phenomenon near caustics. There are many layers of caustics as we now understand. Starting from the big cluster scale caustic, it is disrupted into by these subgalactic dark matter halos, then by the intracluster stars. And then the interesting question is there a very fine layer? And in the era of JWST, data is already pouring in. So the question is, how can we actually make predictions that people think are convincing? So I would like to stop here and take your questions.
Hi, great, thanks, Dan. Right, so our mission is to first start with questions from students. So are there any student questions? Great, so if not, then we'll open up to questions from the audience. It's true that we've had fun so far. But yeah, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I'm curious whether this is kind of crazy. I would imagine the total detection significance might not be too large, but if the source is polarized, I would imagine the polarization would also be magnified.
The polarized, so in gravitational lensing, I think if the source is uniformly magnified, meaning that either it's like isotropically magnified or uniformly sheared, then it doesn't change the polarization. But if it's differentially magnified and if the polarization is non-uniform in different parts of the source, then the overall polarization can change. So for example, that might happen when the star crosses the caustic, because during that time, different part of the star is distorted in very different ways.
So I'm curious about sort of what the ideal, like on the data side, what the ideal approach to like look for this or gather data about this would look like. Would it be like JWST images at a certain cadence or something more specialized?
Yeah, so for this kind of test or this other, you know, resolving the property of the star. Yeah, so you basically, I think the ideal thing, which is people are trying so far, not successful yet, but people are trying, is you first propose a long-term monitoring program. Maybe, you know, you visit every week, visit some promising targets every week. And once you have information suggesting some dramatic microlensing event is going to happen imminently, then you trigger a target of opportunity program. You know, maybe you stare at this source for one day, you know, and see how the light changes. Yeah, I think that should be the best. So for this test, that's the best strategy. But then there's the different test, which is the statistical test. Now, statistical test, I think a promising path is maybe we don't need to actually request a program specifically doing this because there are many other programs just taking pictures of the cluster field for other signs. They want to look for distant galaxies, want to look for supernova. And then over time, there are so many images. And then you can just do image difference and then get some statistics. So that, I think, is another path.
So you talked a little bit about how we can potentially measure properties of stars, like their spin stuff.
For me,
I was excited about Arundel and all these other ones where you can measure like really low metallicity stars.
That's exciting. Yeah.
But what exactly can you do with some of the stuff like the spin? And like I never considered being able to measure that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so the reason, are you asking why we can measure, or are you asking?
No, like I understand that you might be able to get measurements of this, but
right.
What
the science?
What can you learn from that?
Yeah, I think basically you want to know, like, because for example, these fast rotating star, massive stars, they change the evolutionary outcome. Like if you want to explain long GRBs, then you might need you need faster rotating progenitor stars. The other thing is massive star evolution. If the stars are faster rotating, then it changes the internal mixing of the elements, then it changes the stellar evolution. So, I guess. The idea is, you can directly measure local Milky Way stars, but they are not like in extreme environment. So you will learn a lot, but it's difficult to learn what happens to like let's say this low metallicity environment. Yeah. So you basically get. I would not immediately say that you will. Learn everything that you can possibly learn, but at least I think it's you're getting some new information that is otherwise very difficult to get.
Okay, so last question.
So thank you. So I just wanted to let you know. So I guess maybe a similar line of thought is something we thought about. And instead of looking at individual stars, we're looking at quasars, multiply imaged quasars, and then. You could basically play the same game. Is that there could be the effect of microlensing, and then there could be the effect of dark matter, microhalos, and then you can try to separate them based on their time dependence.
Mm-hmm.
The source you're looking at is very different. It's an accretion disk around the quasar as opposed to a star, but of course it's much brighter, so that's the advantage. So I think that could be a different way, a possibly complementary way of going after the same kind of physics.
Yes, so that's a good question. I think indeed I thought about it a bit. Mm-hmm. So for quasars, microlensing of quasars have been observed. But if you want to probe, let's say, these microstructures with quasars, then the question is basically on what scale. I think quasar, you can definitely probe some scale. For these kind of QCD axion mini halo scale, the quasar is a little bit too big. So then you will still have effect, which is different parts of the quasar is magnified by different parts. So they don't completely average out. You will still get some small fractional effect. So then I think we try to compare to the empirically measured quasar temporal power spectrum. But at that time, we seem to conclude that the power spectrum is, even on very short time scale, the power is still large enough that maybe it's not...
A single
quasar.
But a strongly lensed quasar is a different story, right? Because we could separate the... effects. But we can talk about. I know it's late.
Yeah, we can.
So then let's continue downstairs. There were questions downstairs. And thanks again, Leon, for a great talk.
Thank you.